The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
My name is Manuel Rodríguez Orellana. I'm from Puerto Rico, and the program says that I am a former senator and minority leader for the Puerto Rican Independence Party. That is as misleading as saying that we're going to talk about Puerto Rico's legal reality. Okay? We can... Both things are true, but they're not the whole truth. And so let me tell you a little bit about myself before I go on. I'm also a former law professor, and I taught at Northeastern Law School in Boston for many years, and then I went back to Puerto Rico and worked in politics and the academia intermittently. And I am a member of the Puerto Rican Independence Party, so coming from the United States, where I was a quote-unquote minority, I went back to my country, where I was, and still am, a minority. And in order not to lose that track record, I developed MS, which is mostly a condition of Nordic white young women. And I developed that after 50. So I continue to be in the minority, except that now I qualify for President of the United States, according to West Wing. Anyway, let me start by talking a little bit about what we're going to talk about. I would like to make this as informal as possible and to have your input and your questions and comments as we go along. I was telling somebody last night that to talk about the legal reality of Puerto Rico is to talk about a little bit like fiction. The reason for that is I thought of the Quixote by Cervantes, and you know that you've heard of Don Quixote and Man of La Mancha, at least, anyway. Anyway, the novel, it's a novel, and it starts out with Cervantes, the author, telling us that he bought this manuscript at a bazaar in southern Spain from an Arab who sold it to him, and it was written in Arabic. So he got this Arab to translate it for him, and he jotted down the translation made by this Arab of a document written in Arabic by an Arab known as Sidi Amete Benengeli. So by the time that we get to the first page of the novel, which begins, "En un lugar de la Mancha de cuyo nombre no quiero acordarme," you're already about four levels removed from the presumed reality. So when we talk about legal reality, we're already about four or five levels removed from the original reality, because it, at least, as you well know, as law students should know, what happens is what people tell their lawyers, and their lawyers tell the judge, and the judge tells the appellate court, and the appellate court tells the court of highest appeal, who then writes the opinion, and that's what you think happened. But that's really at least four levels removed. So we're going to try to cut through all these levels and talk a little bit about why we're there and what is it that it means. There's three laws, basic laws, that have governed Puerto Rico since the United States invasion of Puerto Rico in 1898. That's, I guess, where we should start. Puerto Rico was taken over by the United States as part of the war with Spain in 1898, in which the United States took over Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. Cuba became at least nominally independent in 1901, and then Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines remained territories of the United States. So that, if we were going to say what Puerto Rico's reality is, legal reality is, we could simply say it's a territory of the United States. Why? Because the U.S. Constitution has a clause that empowers the Congress of the United States to make all needful rules and regulations to at disposal of anything that needs to be done in the territories and other property of the United States. So under that clause, Puerto Rico is a territory, as were all of the states west of the 13 colonies that eventually became states of the Union. So during the 19th century, the territory clause was the territory clause. And that would have been the case after 1898, except that the territory clause then became something a little different from the territory clause. It applied, according to the Supreme Court, in two ways. To incorporate a territory or to not incorporate a territory. So the territories that were incorporated had the promise of statehood, of that is, of becoming a province of the United States. And these were mainly the territories that were populated by Americans who moved westward or southward or whatever, and killed a few Indians, or more than a few Indians, and displaced other Native Americans and so on, and all the way up to Alaska. And Hawaii is a case that's very peculiar, because although it coalesced around the American settlers, the Hawaiian Native people were a tiny minority by the time that Hawaii became a state, and it was populated mostly with immigrants from the Far East and the other Pacific Islands. Now, that's what incorporated territories are, and the Supreme Court has said that incorporated territories are incorporated territories when the Congress specifically and explicitly says they are incorporated territories. In the case of Puerto Rico, since a whole bunch of cases that went from 1900 to 1922, called the insular cases as a group, decided that Puerto Rico was not an incorporated territory. And that was called, lo and behold, an unincorporated territory. Okay? And there were dissents ever since then that the United States Constitution did not really foresee the United States holding territories as mere colonies forever. But that's basically what has happened with Puerto Rico. The Philippines went on to independence in 1936, and then it was put in abeyance until after the Second World War, and eventually in the 1940s became an independent country. But Guam and the Virgin Islands, that was acquired, purchased from Denmark in 1917, have become the unincorporated territories with Puerto Rico. So what's going to happen there? Well, the Supreme Court has recently, since 1900 to as recently as the 1980s, has reiterated its doctrine that Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory. What does that mean? Well, in pure and unadulterated legalese, it means that Puerto Rico belongs to but is not a part of the United States. Okay? And that's the situation with the three laws that the U.S. Congress has passed throughout the century, 20th century, regarding Puerto Rico. From 1898 to 1900, there was a military government, because there was no referendum to inquire from the people of Puerto Rico whether Puerto Rico wanted to become a territory or incorporated or not. So in 1900, Congress began its legislation over the territory of Puerto Rico. And the first law in 1900 was known as the Foreigner Act. 1917 was the second one, the Jones Act, and the 1950-52 was the Federal Relations Act, which incorporated some of the provisions of the Jones Act of 1917, and then allowed for Puerto Rico to draft a local constitution, in other words, to move around the furniture in the living room, but don't break down any walls or open any windows. No structural changes, okay? And everything else remained the same. And what does that mean? What is the same? Since 1900 in the Foraker Act, Puerto Rico was part of the U.S. integrated tariff system. In other words, Puerto Rico was within the U.S. tariff system of the United States. Any exports or imports have to go through U.S. customs and U.S. tariffs or whatever. The dollar became the main currency, the only currency, since 1900. Since 1900, Puerto Rico was excluded from the application of federal tax laws. Okay? In 1970, and it established a House of Delegates to be elected in Puerto Rico, of course, men only, and that was the only elected body, and the President of the United States appointed the governor and the council of, I forget what it was called, but the equivalent of the Senate, and the Attorney General and the Supreme Court. The idea was to turn Puerto Rico from a civil law system to the superior, presumably, common law system, according to the Supreme Court or to the U.S. authorities. So that, having been done in Louisiana, where you have what is called a hybrid jurisdiction, in which you have civil law and common law doctrines coexisting, was the case that began to develop in Puerto Rico. There's a lot of literature on that, law review articles have been written on it, especially you can find a lot of them in the Tulane Law Review from the mid-1940s on that legal situation, the Court of Two Systems, so-called. Anyway, so in 1917, something else happened with the Jones Act, and that was the imposition of U.S. citizenship on Puerto Rico, on Puerto Ricans. And I use the term imposition on purpose. It was not a request by the people of Puerto Rico. In fact, it was over the objection of the only elected body, which unanimously voted against the U.S. Congress extending, quote-unquote, U.S. citizenship to Puerto Rico. The president of the House of Delegates in those days was a Puerto Rican poet, lawyer, brilliant litigator. His name was José de Diego. And he signed the memorandum to the president and the Congress of the United States saying thank you, but no thank you. In other words, there's only one citizenship, he said, that we would want above and beyond Puerto Rican citizenship, and that is celestial citizenship, but only after death. But of course, the territory clause empowered the United States to do whatever it considered needful for the administration of properties and territories, including Puerto Rico. So since 1917, Puerto Ricans became U.S. citizens unless within 6 months or whatever, I forget the exact period of time, they went somewhere and signed a piece of paper saying they did not want U.S. citizenship, in which case they were not U.S. citizens but had no citizens, no citizenship. And of course, all of those had died since then. And it was a small group because you would be left in your own country without the ability to exercise your legal rights as immigrants in your own country. Anyway, so that was the case, and after that, there were a few modifications to each of these statutes, and every Puerto Rican born after that time is a U.S. citizenship by birth, by action of the statute of the Jones Act. There's a lot of legal theories and controversies surrounding that citizenship, whether it's a real citizenship or a bogus citizenship, whether it's first-class citizenship or a second-class citizenship, and those are very nice and interesting legal arguments, which don't affect the reality that if Puerto Ricans move to the United States and register to vote here, they vote here, and it doesn't alter the fact that if an American moves to Puerto Rico and registers to vote there, cannot vote here, okay, in federal elections. So that means that the establishment of the territory is such that Puerto Ricans now, after the Federal Relations Act, can elect their own local government, including all the Jones Act, that of the Senate, can elect the Senate, a governor, and the governor appoints the justices of the Supreme Court, and the Senate confirms it. Pretty much the quote-unquote Republican form of government, as it's called. And that's it. Everything else is legislated by the U.S. Congress. By everything else, I mean everything that is within the purview of federal legislation applies in Puerto Rico, unless Congress specifically says that it doesn't. And what has it said that is not within that purview? Well, federal taxation. Federal income tax does not apply in Puerto Rico. But Social Security taxes, Medicare, Medicaid, all of those things do apply in Puerto Rico. Puerto Ricans pay the same amount as anybody else within the United States. But we, however, are excluded from how much can the benefits that accrue to Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico by virtue of the Social Security and Medicare. So there is a cap on that, so Puerto Ricans get less, even though they pay the same. Okay. Presumably, since you don't pay federal taxes, income taxes, that's okay. Except that local Puerto Rican income tax is higher than federal income tax. So anyway, it balances unevenly, which means it doesn't balance out. That is the reality of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, of course, in its constitution, so-called constitution in 1952, adopted the idea that the death penalty is abolished and that there could be no interception of telephone communications. Well, that is the law in Puerto Rico, except for the U.S. government. The U.S. government can apply the death penalty in Puerto Rico, and the U.S. government can intercept telephone calls and private communications in Puerto Rico. So anything that Puerto Ricans can do is okay, so long as the federal government has not preempted the field. You will say, well, that's like a state.
Yes.
Except we don't vote. Okay. In other words, this is what the Commonwealthers now call a democratic deficit. They always come up with these niceties. A democratic deficit. In other words, it doesn't sound right that you would be governed in every aspect of your life. Even the making of morcillas, you know what morcillas are, right? Is subject to federal regulation. That you'll be governed in every aspect of your life by a government in which you have absolutely no say. Okay? That is, under constitutional law and constitutional terms, a territory. In international law terms, it's called a colony. Okay? And colonialism in international law is a no-no. It's been abolished. It's been recognized by international legal scholars and the development of international law that colonialism is an obstacle to world peace and so on and so forth. Well, anyway, that is the situation regarding Puerto Rico. Now, why these three laws? Let's start cutting across some of these layers. 1900 to 1918, there were some things happening in the world that involved the United States. Since the 1890s until 1918, there were these plans to cut a hole through the Central American isthmus and dig a canal that would join the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, which was essential for commerce, trade, and development. The United States wanted to do that, and so it wanted to convince whatever government was in power to do that. And, of course, at that time, Panama was part of Colombia. So the United States made sure that there was a revolt in the Panamanian province, and Panama became an independent republic supported by the United States to grant permission to dig a hole.
All right. Then, once you dig a hole, you need to protect it. Who's going to go through? Well, certainly only friends will be allowed through.
And that means that the United States needed to guard the entrance to the canal and the entrance to the Caribbean. And national security issues were involved.
So strategic military interests required an outpost, a military base, military outpost
for the United States from which it could guard that route.
Puerto Rico was perfect there in 1898. It was small, not big like Cuba. The people of Puerto Rico were not fighting an armed struggle for independence, as was Cuba in those days. And so it was, that's why Puerto Rico was kept and Cuba was allowed nominally to leave in 1901. Then, of course, international law requires a justification for you to stop ships that come by. Also, the First World War developed. And so you have this Monroe Doctrine to protect the Western Hemisphere from European influence and so on since the early part of the 18th century. Let's put it in vigor. Let's put it in practice. How can we justify stopping these ships, German or otherwise? Well, we're protecting U.S. citizens. Yeah, but we don't have that many Americans in Puerto Rico. Fine, let's make them all Americans. Okay? And that way we protect them. And that's what happened. That explains the imposition of citizenship from a policy perspective in 1917. And then naturally, things continued to develop. And then we're all the way to a Second World War. And there was Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and Franco, and you needed to protect the world for democratic values. So Puerto Rico was essential as a military outpost. Then came the Third World War after 1945.
That's the Cold War.
Okay. So you needed an answer to an irrelevant question. Cuba.
So after the Cuban Revolution, then Puerto Rico was the answer, the democratic answer to the communist dictatorship in Cuba.
The showcase of the Caribbean, the showcase of democracy, and so on and so forth. And so the United States, Puerto Rico, developed policies to stimulate economic growth in Puerto Rico. So there was Puerto Rico since 1900 within the U.S. tariff system, under the U.S. flag, a poor island, so wages were lower. Congress could decide whether to make the wages higher or not, or keep them where they were. It was a safe place for investment. And after the Second World War, the United States came out with a superavit of economic development and needed a place to invest. So there was Puerto Rico for manufacturing. And that brought about the so-called peaceful revolution of Puerto Rico, which transformed Puerto Rico from an agrarian society to a modern industrialized economy, at least on the surface. But you couldn't create enough jobs for everybody, so you needed to have an escape valve. And since Puerto Ricans, since 1917, were U.S. citizens, ship them up, okay, to pick apples in Connecticut or whatever, and then, baby, you're on your own, okay? So that combined to make Puerto Rico sort of the showcase of the Caribbean. And Puerto Rico's economy was growing at a very fast rate in the 1950s and 60s. And it really changed the nature of Puerto Rican society to more an urban than an agrarian or rural society. people work, people have needs, prices go up, wages need to go up, and so it became more expensive. In other words, then you needed to, you couldn't send everybody up there, you couldn't just ship everybody to different places, so you needed to keep them quiet. Ah, federal transfers. In 1960, 3 cents out of every dollar in a Puerto Rican's pocket came from federal funds. At present, 35 cents out of every dollar come from federal funds. So that creates an enormous economic dependence. Now, that is one picture of it. The other thing is that as these three world wars and as these three situations were taking place and the transformation of the Monroe Doctrine was becoming less of a protective and more of an aggressive policy towards Latin America, then, and the United States emerged as a world power after the Second World War, and then you went into conflict in a bipolar world with the United States and the Soviet Union in these two poles. At the same time, something else was happening throughout the 20th century. And there were several waves of nationalism developing in the world. In the first 30 years of the 20th century, well, that's when Hitler and Mussolini came into power in the extreme mode. But that's also when Ireland, after 800 years of domination by England, was able to achieve its transition towards independence. And in the 1920s, the leader of the Irish liberation movement, Eamon de Valera, whom you may have heard of, visited Boston in 1915, 16, 17, to raise funds from Irish immigrants to Boston. And at that time, there was a Puerto Rican studying at Harvard Law School. His name was Pedro Albizu Campos. And he came in contact with de Valera. Shall we dance? And he came in contact with that. And that sort of got Don Pedro into the wavelength of the Irish liberation movement, which in Puerto Rico, where there already were people who advocated independence and political parties that advocated independence and had it in their platforms, Don Pedro then became a member of the Nationalist Party in Puerto Rico and eventually became the head of the Nationalist Party in Puerto Rico and the maximum exponent of nationalism's culmination into political independence. Okay? You have a nation, the logical thing is that nation should have its sovereign powers to decide its own future. In the 1930s, actually in the 1940s, the second wave of nationalism after the Second World War, with many of the former colonies of European nations becoming independent and in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, particularly in the Caribbean. So what you have then going on simultaneously during the period of those three big statutes that the Congress approved regarding Puerto Rico was in Puerto Rico the rise of nationalist ideologies affecting the political climate in Puerto Rico and the consolidation of Puerto Rico's national identity through the 1940s. How did this happen? Well, you know, nations don't happen overnight, and they don't happen because you have a decree that now you're a nation. Nations develop sociologically, historically, culturally, linguistically, and that's the same way with Puerto Rico. From after the Spanish invasion of 1493, or discovery, although people who lived there knew exactly what it was, then the creolization process began. That is, Spaniards began feeling differently about Spain because they were living elsewhere, which is normal. once they started intermarrying with the few native Puerto Ricans, the Taino Indians, that they didn't kill off, that also began to develop a different sense of identity. And then, when African slaves were brought to Puerto Rico, that sort of completed the gestalt, so to speak, of sociology and history. And Puerto Ricans developed as something different, not just from Spain, something different from the Dominican Republic next door, different from Cuba, a little bit farther away, different from everybody else, but similar to other Latin American Caribbean nations, including the Spanish language. So that difference began to acquire a sense of identity that manifested itself in a nationalist uprising in 1868 against Spain. And this was the Lares Uprising, Grito de Lares, as it was called. So that marked the beginning of Puerto Rico's struggle against colonialism, first with Spain. Many people thought, when the Americans invaded, that that was a good thing because Spain was bad news. So put an end to the Spanish rule, and the Americans, who said they came in the name of democracy, General Nelson Miles' proclamation had all of these rhetorical exuberance, we come in the name of democracy to bring you tidings of great joy, and so on and so forth. And we're hopeful that this would develop into Puerto Rico liberating itself from colonialism. And that took two approaches. One was the independence approach, naturally, and a lot of people thought that would be the natural course. And the other one was the autonomist and statehood approach. Why I say and not or? Because autonomy with Spain meant pretty much what they thought statehood meant with the United States. In other words, you would have a place in the parliament making the laws that govern you, but you would have local autonomy. Okay? And that made some people in Puerto Rico view the United States as a republic of republics. You know, the states of the Union were states in the international legal sense. At least that's how they saw it. Of course, the Great Depression and Franklin Roosevelt and the expansion of federal power and so on and so forth, which you already know from your constitutional law courses, changed all that. And states' rights is now only, it's been associated with a doctrine of a racist reactionary vision in the United States. But that was the original vision by everybody, you know, states' rights. So many people in Puerto Rico saw it that way. But it soon became clear with the legal development of the doctrine of unincorporated territories that there was really no intention of allowing Puerto Rico to have the same rights as everybody else governed under the U.S. Constitution. And so after the Second World War and the second rise in colonialist ideology and the reaffirmation of Puerto Rico's national identity that took place since the 1940s, 30s and 40s in Puerto Rico, in part due to the nationalist struggles of Pedro Luis Ocampo, and in part due to the way things developed, where if you can't defend yourself against a powerful empire with weapons, then you defend yourself as you best can, which is your culture. So Puerto Rican culture developed, flourished, I would say, in the 1930s and 40s, both at the popular level and at the so-called high culture level. In the popular level, those of you who may be familiar with the boleros, the love songs, Rafael Hernandez, Pedro Flores, and so on and so forth, were Latin American. So there was an affirmation of Puerto Rico as a Latin American identity. The Cuban boleros or the Cuban authors lived in Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rican authors lived in Cuba and in Mexico and so on and so forth. But also in poetry, and you had, or in painting, for instance, in the, to take the arts, Trufino, Rosado, Pancho Rodon, all of these great painters who are not just the local but also the universal. Okay? In literature, for instance, you have poetry. Llorens Torres, Pales Matos, and so on and so forth. And in the present time, in fiction, for instance, Ana Lidia Vega, Luis Rafael Sanchez. So you develop the whole body of literature, music, and politics. Politics. That horrible thing that law doesn't concern itself with. Or does it? Anyway, so in politics, the influence of the nationalist movement, the influence of the Cultural Reformation, brought Puerto Rico, like everybody else, after the Second World War, to the edge of deciding what it would do with its future, or at least so thought Puerto Ricans. So the government of Puerto Rico, not under a Puerto Rican governor, was the last appointed U.S. governor in Puerto Rico, vetoed a law that was passed by the Puerto Rican legislature calling for a referendum for Puerto Ricans to choose between or among statehood, dominion status, or protectorate, which had presumably more powers more like an autonomous Canada-type relationship with Britain, and independence. And the governor of Puerto Rico, Rexford Tugwell, vetoed it. The Puerto Rican legislature overrode his veto. So under the rules then, it went to the President of the United States. And the President of the United States, upon Tugwell's recommendation, vetoed it. The reason? Because Tugwell said, if we hold a referendum now, Puerto Ricans will vote for independence, and we can't allow that. Okay? Why? Logical. Beginning of the Third World War, the Cold War. Puerto Rico needed to be kept. I mean, there's a lot of stories that I could tell you, anecdotes that I know of. Back in the late 70s, I came to Washington one day, and a friend of mine put me in contact with former CIA operative in Latin America, was an old man at that point, and he told me he was with Luis Muñoz Marin, who was governor of Puerto Rico for a long time, in Washington in 1945, when in the last months of Roosevelt's life. And I don't know if you know this, but Muñoz was very close to a very dear friend of Mrs. Roosevelt. So he had a lot of influence in the White House. And he went to see Roosevelt. It was obvious that the Second World War was approaching its end. And he told me this story. I mean, I'm not making it up. And he said that he went with him, and they went to see Roosevelt. And Muñoz said, well, the war is almost over. I suppose we're now going for independence. And Roosevelt said, forget about it. We need Puerto Rico as a base. It's national security, so forget about it. Independence is out of the question. Okay? The other part is kind of sad. Presumably Muñoz lowered his head and he cried bitterly. Okay? It's not a good way to fight for independence, but you know, that's what happened. Anyway, so that decided the situation, and Puerto Rico's colonial situation needed to needed to make the United States needed to make it seem to go away. Let's put it that way. So the Commonwealth was established in that third legislation, the Law of Federal Relations, that allowed local government. So that's been the situation now. Cold War is over since at least 1989, when they brought down the Berlin Wall. But the colony continues. And the military justification for holding the colony is no longer there. It's not so much that it's no longer there, but military presence in Puerto Rico is practically nil at this point, especially after Vieques. I don't know if you know about Vieques. Vieques is an island municipality of the East Coast that was being used as a bombing range for the U.S. Navy for about 60 years, until finally, even though there were many hit near misses, I mean a bomb that exploded 1 mile offshore when it should have exploded 6 miles offshore, one that almost exploded in the town square, but you know, these were near misses until there was a hit, and one of these bombs went off course and killed a civilian guard in the observation post, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And the people of Vieques and the people of Puerto Rico decided enough is enough. And the independence movement, I dare say, led by the president of the Independence Party, who camped out in the firing range for 382 days. Okay, I know, it was horrible. I visited him there several times. I spent weekends. It was horrible. 7 o'clock in the morning, the heat was unbearable, and you couldn't do anything. The mosquitoes were like fighter planes, zoom. Nights were gorgeous, beautiful. But he was there for 382 days until they finally removed him, and then a process of civil disobedience to get arrested continued and ensued, and more than 1,500 Puerto Ricans violated the federal order and the federal laws and entered U.S. restricted areas, and some of us spent more time than we cared for in prison for a misdemeanor, which was a trespass, eventually the pressure became too much and it reached the international community, and the United States backed out because it didn't need Puerto Rico anymore. Okay, let's not kid ourselves. I mean, we were able to put that pressure because it was no longer necessary, but the U.S. was not going to leave there unless forced to. And that's what happened. Well, now, what is the justification for the colony? Well, we don't know. There is nothing that Puerto Rico couldn't do under sovereignty that it could do in any other form or status. It's the most flexible way to reach commercial treaties, agreements, and so on and so forth, to stimulate the economy, to insert Puerto Rico into the global economy. But what has been happening is the increasing economic dependence that I talked about before has all of a sudden been highlighted by the awareness, increased awareness of political powerlessness that Puerto Rico experiences. And let me just give you two or three examples. War in Iraq. Well, it's not that there's a draft and people are forced to go into the army, but Puerto Ricans have no choice because they have no other alternatives to look forward to in terms of their own economic well-being and career development. So the army becomes an option, the military career, not career, the military, the promise of a PX down the way. That's why the population in the U.S. Forces is pretty much the same as the population in U.S. prisons. Blacks, Latinos, poor white, and that's the same composition, and that's why people move in that direction. Well, Puerto Rico cannot do anything to curtail that or to create alternatives, social alternatives and economic alternatives for our people. Also, the FBI is out of control. I don't know if you heard, but recently they murdered a Puerto Rican patriot who had been AWOL. He had cut his electronic surveillance bracelet 15 years ago. On the 23rd of September of 1990, 23rd of September is when we commemorate the Lares uprising against Spain in 1868. So he went underground 15 years ago on September 23rd. And on September 23rd this year, 15 years later, exactly to the date, the FBI surrounded his home and killed him. They're doing an investigation now. I don't know whether we will ever know the truth, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that this is a case of state terrorism and murder. He was 72 years old. He lived alone with his wife. The United States intelligence forces can find Saddam Hussein in the midst of a desert, inside a cave. They knew. They had to know where he was. So they surrounded his home. They let his wife come out. He said he would negotiate his surrender through a newspaper reporter named Jesus Davila. That was rejected. And night came, the Puerto Rico government cut electricity and infrared sightings or whatever, and they killed him. And he was allowed to bleed to death. Okay? So this is something outrageous to Puerto Ricans, whether you liked his methods or not. And those weren't the methods that we agree with and that I agree with in my party and I personally. But, you know, the man was not a criminal. He wasn't stealing for self-motivation, for things for himself. He wasn't, in 15 years, he hadn't done anything to anybody. And he just gave interviews every now and then and released tape recordings of his sermons about the way the independence movement should behave and so on and so forth. You didn't have to kill him. So people were outraged. I mean, to say that a person who was accused of quote-unquote terrorism in Puerto Rico would have his funeral held at the Puerto Rico Bar Association and the Archbishop of San Juan would come and pay his respects tells you something about Puerto Rican society. It's something that you don't like to see, the abuses, and you're outraged at that. Okay? Whether they come from the Americans or not. If we only didn't need them, that's what people who think we need the present status say, if we only didn't need them, we could do something else. Well, so that combined with the U.S. unwillingness to recognize its obligation and get its act together, continues to have Puerto Rico in its current legal reality, a territory under the U.S. Constitution. So what's the prospect for the future? The realization that democracy is impossible between a master and a slave, metropolis and colony. So the alternatives are the status quo or statehood. Well, you know, it's a bad fit into the world of politics. It's a failure to quickly assimilate. There's another panel going on right now, precisely about the problems that are arising in southern states because of increased migration from Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America, and the violence that erupts surrounding that, most of which is not, as I was speaking to one of the panelists just before I came over, most of which is not punished, but goes on. So it's a bad fit, it creates instability. The other thing is, there's this increasing sense of national identity of Puerto Ricans is combined in view of the powerlessness, political powerlessness, with everybody wanting to exercise some power, to have more power. And I don't, of course, limit myself to independentistas. Of course, we want it all. Okay, we want to have the same rights that any other independent nation has to trade with whomever we want to trade under the terms that will be mutually convenient, including the United States. The other thing is, of course, that the stakeholders and those that favor the status quo also want more powers. The Commonwealthers want the power of nullification to fix the democratic deficit. What's that mean? You remember during the Civil War, one of the reasons was that the southern states refused to abide by federal laws or congressional laws and claimed the right to decide which federal laws would apply in the states or not. That's states' rights in those days. Well, that's the power of nullification. The Commonwealthers, in their desire to fix that democratic deficit, want to fix the generic consent that presumably was given by Puerto Ricans to being governed by all laws present, past, and future of the United States. And so we will decide which laws apply. Well, that doesn't fit into the U.S. constitutional mold. That's not the way it works. Statehood is still viewing the thing as very nationalistic about many things in Puerto Rico, more so times than we are. Continue to view the possibility of a nation within a nation. The Republic of Republics instead is now a nation of nations. And so Puerto Rico could be admitted as a separate nation under the United States. Well, that's right now what's creating problems. So you don't invite more problems. It creates instability. And it's a sign of that. Statehooders argue for statehood with reason, because Puerto Rico would then contribute less to the federal treasury than most states, receive more from the federal treasury than most states, and have more power than most of the states in the U.S. Congress. In exchange for what? You don't even need us as a base anymore. So that's not, it doesn't make sense. And we don't have the votes, the independentistas, because, you know, in the 1950s, there was a systematic persecution of independentistas. Independence was made to coincide in the popular mind and under official propaganda with death, hunger, starvation, communism, and you name any evil under the sun. Strangely, I mean, there's 185 nations in the world and only one Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. So there must be something wrong systemically with the situation. But we don't have the votes. For good reasons, you know. People have been made to think all of those horrible things about independence. Which is, of course, bogus. The United States can enter into an agreement for reasonable transition of Puerto Rico to independence and make Puerto Rico a prosperous Latin American Caribbean nation that can integrate into the multiplicity of production systems in the Caribbean and develop in the region a good trading partner for the United States. It's good for everybody. Now, how do you do that? Well, I think this has to happen fairly soon, because it's no longer tenable. Recently, in what I think has been the most unambiguous statement of the people of Puerto Rico about resolving the colonial status, the legislature of Puerto Rico, both House and Senate, unanimously passed a bill that would have held a referendum this summer to demand from the President and the Congress of the United States that they commit themselves to respond to a petition for a non-colonial, non-territorial status for Puerto Rico. That's a demand for decolonization. Okay? Everybody was for it. All three Puerto Rican parties were for it. And then the governor vetoed it. Why? I don't know. I mean, the reasons he stated it was an express veto have nothing to do with the bill. Some politician from the opposition party made a statement that he didn't like, and he thought that was disrespectful of the moral commitment to do something else down the line that hasn't been done anyway, and that can't be done unless there's legislation, and the legislature is controlled by the other party. So it had nothing to do with this. So the thing is dead at this point. That is the situation, and it's no longer tenable. That is Puerto Rico's legal reality cutting through all of these layers. I don't know what else to tell you, except that I am more convinced now than before, or than ever in my life, that we're moving without any motion, and that we're going, making haste slowly, towards the decolonization of Puerto Rico. I think that this will happen. I think the beginning of a process is necessary, and I am convinced that this will happen because now it is essential not just for Puerto Rico, but for the United States as well. And you who live here are footing the bill for an economy that's on the dole. An economy where, as I said before, 34 cents out of every dollar come from federal transfers, and at the same time, U.S. corporations in Puerto Rico last year took out $30 billion, which is larger than all of the exports of Chile worldwide, in profits, untaxed in Puerto Rico. If you just impose a modest fee for making that much money in Puerto Rico, you could begin to do a lot of things. And there's an economic plan that is already developed and that we have submitted to various experts in the United States, and in the processes that have taken place since 1989 to the present, the Congressional Joint Tax Committee explored it, the Congressional Budget Office, the General Accounting Office, they have all seen the plan, and they say, well, it's feasible, whereas the others, we don't know where it's going. That's the situation as it is now, and sometimes Americans don't like to hear these things, but, you know, your true friends will always, it's not a true friend who tells you only what you want to hear. Your true friends will tell you the truth, whether you like it or not. And that's my truth. Okay? Comments?
With sovereignty comes, I think the world can respect kind of sovereignty of nations, being independent and governing its own people. If Puerto Rico were to become independent, does it have to, let's assume that at this point Puerto Rico becomes an independent nation, does it have the capacity to support itself economically without that dependence from the United States? Because you mentioned that it's very dependent on the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So one, does it have the capacity to support itself economically adequately and to maintain the economic growth that every country wants? And also, does it have the capacity to defend itself militarily?
Well, let me take the last one first because that's the easier one. The theory is that we have to have the United States there to defend us from foreign invasions. The only people who ever invaded us are still there. So, you know. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that there's anybody really wanting to take over Puerto Rico at this point. Why? You know, what? The theory back a few years was that Fidel Castro had a miliciano behind every palm tree waiting for the chance to jump into Puerto Rico and take it over. Yeah, they've got enough problems of their own. Yeah. So I'm not worried about that. And besides, I would not want a militarized republic. The independence that I believe in is one without an army, like Costa Rica. Of course, you'd have a police, you know, to keep the order and so on, but you don't need an army. And create a caste of military in Puerto Rico doesn't make any sense. With regards to economics, you of course know about drug addiction. You've heard about it. I hope you don't practice it. But if you're an addict and you quit cold turkey, you can convulse and you could die. Nobody's advocating for cold turkey independence. It doesn't make any sense to anybody. There has to be a transition period, and I think it can be done in no more than 10 years, in which Puerto Rico could, for instance, obtain the same amounts of federal transfers, but in block grants, not through specific programs, in block grants, adjusted for inflation during that period of time, in which the government of Puerto Rico would then use that money to stimulate production in Puerto Rico to stimulate investment and to create an economic development program with policies and laws of our own to make that possible. Like 15 or 20 countries that are smaller than Puerto Rico, more populated than Puerto Rico, have absolutely no national resources. They don't have U.S. citizenship and federal laws to deal with, and they have no food stamps. And they, in the last 20 years, developed economically at a far greater pace than Puerto Rico and have gone by Puerto Rico in terms of their economic growth, whereas Puerto Rico has not gone beyond anybody. So I think it can be done. I don't think we need to go cold turkey. It's not good for Puerto Rico. It's not good for the United States. Because after all, whom do we buy things from? The United States. And Puerto Rico is the major consumer market for U.S. goods in this hemisphere. So Sears, JCPenney, McDonald's, Burger King, and so on, I'm not going to let that market go away. And unfortunately, I would like Burger King to go. I think the fondas in Puerto Rico are much better. But anyway, that being beyond my control, they would probably want to stay. So I think that there is the basis there, the material basis for establishing an arrangement, a transitional arrangement that will be beneficial to all. And if we, you know, with around $4 billion a year, which is what the U.S. spends in the war in Iraq every month, with $4 billion a year, with more doctors, teachers, lawyers, accountants, all sorts of professionals than any other colony prior to achieving independence, with the skilled labor force or the semi-skilled labor force, with a fairly decent, by way of contrasting, infrastructure, if we can't make it in 10 years, then maybe we deserve to become a state. Okay. Any other comments, questions? Yeah. Yeah, General Nelson Miles in 1898, his proclamation, it was full of rhetorical exuberance. Yeah. And you can get that in, there's a book called The Last Colony by José Trias Monge. It's written in English. Trias Monge is, or was, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico, and himself a participant in the development of Commonwealth, but also a scholar. And when he didn't talk politics or didn't apply the law, he could be quite honest. In this book, it's a fairly decent analysis of Puerto Rico's history, political, constitutional, and legal history, and you'll find many of the same things that we've talked about here today. But that's a shorter book. There's others that I could recommend. If you know the publication Foreign Affairs, November-December 1997, there's an article in there by Rubén Berríos Martínez. He is the president of the Puerto Rican Independence Party, and he wrote that article called Puerto Rico's Decolonization. It's interesting that the Foreign Affairs asked him to write that article 20 years after he was asked to write the first one, also on Puerto Rico. As you know, Foreign Affairs is kind of the think tank for the foreign policy cardinals of the United States. So they asked him to write that. It's a good article. I recommend it. Yeah?
Two questions. Being that a lot of Puerto Ricans do identify to some degree, whether it might be a lot of the nationalist community with the United States, would a full-fledged state would be such a bad argument for the United States? It seems like a lose-lose situation because you're putting more money into what could be a state that you're getting out of. And how about Puerto Rico, would that be such a bad trade-off? And the second question is, if Fidel Castro, for whatever reason, you know, he's already so old and everything, he were to die today, would that impact have enough of a shakedown in the criminal and more in the way that world politics are viewed, that might be the impetus to get Puerto Rican independence started?
Well, if Fidel Castro dies, and we don't know for sure if he ever will, I don't think that much will be different in Cuba. You've got 40 years of a whole system that has become ingrained, and although people leave for economic reasons, politically a few feel oppressed, and they are oppressed, but most people are happy enough as they are. I think that changes will come about whether he dies or not, okay, because it's in the nature of history to bring about some changes. And I think that it will be good for Puerto Rico because it opens up again the exchanges, the historical exchanges that have existed between Puerto Rico and Cuba since the 1800s, 1860s, and so on and so forth. Very parallel histories, very common cause. I mean, there's a famous poem by a Puerto Rican poet, Cuba y Puerto Rico de un pájaro las dos alas, reciben flores y balas en un mismo corazón. So, I mean, there's a long history of that. And Fidel is no different from the Cuban history with regards to Puerto Rico. Fidel Castro has been a firm supporter of Puerto Rican independence, as were all Cuban leaders in Cuba's history, all the way back to José Martí. So the fact that he's not liked by the United States and that he doesn't like the United States very much doesn't alter the fact that there is a historical commonality there. What was the other question? Stater. Well, the thing about Stater is, first of all, I don't think that the United States is going to really seriously consider it. They pay lip service to it because they want Latinos in the United States to think that they're really concerned about Puerto Ricans. Of course, you know, Don Pedro Albizu Campos said it a long time ago, the Americans are not interested in the birds, only in the cage. And I think that it doesn't make any sense for the United States to make Puerto Rico a state. And if you get a situation in which the United States can promote friendly relations,
and I think there should be, between the United States and Puerto Rico, you can have right of transit, free transit between the two countries for, you know, whatever period of time, and you establish various treaties and so on. I don't see any reason why state would be preferable for the United States. For Puerto Ricans,
I don't see why you should need to hate the United States in order to be independent. You can still like what the United States does. I've lived 15 years of my life in the United States. My formative years were spent here in college. Some of my best friends are American. So there's really no reason why independence should mean anything other than good relations. Puerto Rico right now, I mean, is producing most of the stuff that the United States sells us. Okay, so but especially in high tech, and Puerto Rico could become a kind of a warehouse for the Caribbean to export finished products to the rest of Latin America. You set up a transshipment post, and you become a hub for the Caribbean. There's many ways it can be done. Right now, Puerto Rico is being left out of the global market and isolated because of our legal reality. I think that needs to change. I think it is in the interest of the United States, but it's also the obligation of the United States to dispose of the territory. Because we didn't ask them to come in. And they never cared what we think. So why should they at this point? Except that they want to use the notion of Puerto Rico to make Latinos in the United States believe that they really, really love you. Okay? They love you so much that they want Puerto Rico to stay there as it is, but they won't change it. And we give them a lot of money, which, you know, just throw money at the problem, you know it doesn't work. Liberals found that out. Conservatives will eventually too, as they're beginning to find out with Iraq. Yeah. Yeah, manufacturing is basically gone. The small manufacturing that Puerto Rico thrived on in the 50s and 60s. Now it's it has to be a banking, investment, high tech. That's what Puerto Rico is ready for at this point, and the export of services to the rest of the Caribbean. Anyway, I would love to go on, but I think you have lunch to go to. And I appreciate your being here. Thank you for inviting me, and I enjoyed it a lot. So I'll see you guys around a little later. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I'll probably run into you again. No mucho.
Pero si sabe, hay algo de poesía.
Ah, bueno, sí, bueno, me encanta la poesía. Pero yo veo que en Puerto Rico hay una tradición de improvisar versos. Improvisar. Sí. Yo en eso no soy bueno.
Ah, no, pero fue algo de Puerta, pero de Veracruz.
Ah, sí.
Y la tradición es muy parecida.
Sí, sí, sí.
Lo estamos en ese,
sí, claro, seguro.
Pero no sé si
tendrá
una tarjeta.
Sí,
como no.
Sí, mucho gusto.
Yo voy a preguntar.
Sí, como no.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you for coming.
We appreciate you speaking. I wanted to ask you a quick question. I wanted to know if in the Puerto Rican Bar Association there's a different breakdown, a different political party breakdown than that of the rest of the island, whether it's more people are stated or independent.
It's hard to tell. The Bar Association as such usually takes more liberal views than the government, particularly with regards to decolonization. And it's been on record since the 1960s as favoring decolonization, and it always makes a presentation at the United Nations Decolonization Committee every year. So there's already a precedent established and clearly set that the Bar Association's position is that. Lawyers are lawyers, so I can't respond for them. I don't know, but most, I guess, depends on the